Oh, sitting in the garage. Big Jim's Garage. Hi, I'm Big Jim O'Brien, your host here. Thank you so much for joining us. A little change here as we roll into episode 101. We're not going to be about cars. We will, but not just cars. You sit in the garage, you talk about it. Look what you've done to your garage, Ryan Logan, our producer here on the Big Jim's House show. It's become your cave, right?
More of an outside basement, right? Yeah, just a cool hangout.
Exactly. And I've heard stories. I was reading, actually, one of the podcasts you'll hear on there is from Phoebe Wall Leonard from the Detroit Free Press, here where we tape this, about how, and she was sharing with me that, like, all these trucks that everybody's buying, you know, everybody you know is buying a pickup truck, right?
Right.
They're too damn big for the garage. So they're having to stretch garages and narrow cabinets and stuff. So some people are paying to have the cabinets go from, like, I never knew this was the spec, 24 inches to 16 inches in depth. Or they're knocking out a wall and going, like, 4 feet back.
Really?
Seriously, man. There was a picture of a guy who had, like, a Yukon, and he lived in Royal Oak. If you listen to this, it's kind of a trendy, cool community, older homes, and he's got the detached garage. He couldn't get his car, his SUV, into the garage. Just didn't fit.
Yeah, especially a lot of those garages in Royal Oak and Ferndale, the local areas that are the one car, you know, skinny driveway garages.
Yeah.
You can't fit anything in there.
But that's the new thing. So the garage become the room. So that's where, you know, I have friends come over and talk. We're putting together a grill or just wrenching on something on a Saturday. So that's the idea. This week on our Big Jim's Garage podcast, Vern Lundquist, new book, Play by Play. We'll talk with him. And then we'll talk about the USFL. My buddy Jeff, Jeff's got a fantastic book about the USFL, Football for a Buck. Gets in a lot about what happened with Donald Trump and whatnot when he took over the New Jersey Generals.
Oh, that's interesting.
A lot of people forget that Trump was a football owner at one time. And what happened? He had Doug Flutie and Herschel Walker on the same team.
Not a bad start as an owner, right?
Yeah, but there's a lot to it. So Jeff will be on. Jeff Perlman will be on with us. Football for a Buck. Okay, I wanted to bring in Ryan, our producer. Ryan Logan, if you don't know, also hosts a podcast called Inside the Ring, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you and I talk UFC all the time. Every time there's a big fight. And everybody's talking about Conor McGregor and the aftermath of this. We're a week away from it now. All the crap with fighting outside the cage. The one thing that did get buried by all this is the fact that, have you ever seen Conor McGregor get his ass kicked like that?
Not like that, where it was just completely down. I mean, he couldn't do anything. If he got taken down, that was it. He was getting held down.
Because, like, the Diaz fight, the first one, he just gassed out.
Right.
But the first two rounds, he was beating his ass, wasn't he?
Yeah, and they were both, it's both kind of beating each other's ass. I mean, they're just throwing haymakers at each other, and that was it. And they just got, you know, one guy was going to get tired before the next guy came down to conditioning. But with the Khabib fight, he literally couldn't do anything. If he got close to him and Khabib took him down, that was it. The round was ending with them on the ground.
Right, and that's that whole day. I remember hearing this term, I learned it, chain wrestling. How they go from one move to the next, to the next, to the next. Like a lot of the wrestlers, if you watch the old days of the UFC, the guys like they shoot a double, which means just they're trying to grab both legs, right?
Right.
They get a double, and if they don't get it, they get kicked in the face and then back up. Khabib just doesn't stop. He just keeps moving, trying to get another move, another move, another move, another move.
Well, there's a couple times where Khabib went from like an armbar to a leg lock back to it, and it really is just like combo wrestling.
Yeah, that's that chain stuff they're talking about. So here's the deal with Khabib, and I was thinking about Conor McGregor. What happened to Ronda Rousey when she lost the second fight? She was done in the UFC. She had been whipped twice. Holly Holm was a shock.
Right.
But then when she came back after all that and emotionally came back, and Amanda Nunes, what was it, 40-something seconds? It didn't last long, man.
Yeah, it didn't go to a second round, that's for sure.
She got blasted. So if McGregor comes back, and you and I have been talking about this off mic for a while, other than Khabib, who else does he have to fight? For motivation purposes, not money, but that fire that all these fighters, no matter it's boxing or whatever, that fire that they've got to have, that motivation to get in the ring and do what they do.
I really don't think there's anybody. I don't think he needs to prove himself to anybody else in the UFC, and really there's nobody. This Khabib storyline was way, you know, became much bigger than just the fight. It became kind of country versus country, so he had that, and that's the motivation, but I don't see... Besides money, you know, there's no real rivalries or anything like there was when he first came up, or, you know, with the Diaz stuff and the back and forth there.
So does, and I guess that's my question. So, you know, McGregor finds the motivation in beating the one guy who just wrecked him, right?
Right.
But if he loses that fight, if he loses twice to Khabib, is he done? You know what, though? That's not fair because look at Cormier.
I mean, Cormier's done nothing but lose to guys and come back and has always gotten his shot back.
Well, even John Jones. I mean, I know one of them was DQ'd because of the drug testing, but still, John Jones beat him pretty handily twice.
But he's also not close to a billionaire. You know what I mean? I don't think Connor, I think it's got to take a lot to get him back into the ring. Because right now, if you pay him $50 million, that he can make that easy now doing other things.
But we don't know what the terms of this deal with the UFC. No one has, unless I'm mistaken, but nobody has disclosed this.
Yeah, all we know is six fights is what he signed for. But also with him, I think you can kind of see him when he gets back into it. This was a much different Conor McGregor to me. I mean, the trash talking and all of that was still there. But the discipline and him talking about, you know, going to have a drink with guys the couple days before the fight and stuff. I mean, that might just be all head games, but it's still, it seems like a, I mean, he's a superstar now. He's not just fighter famous. He's world famous. So.
Yeah. And you could watch during the fight that left hand that's so quick. He just felt like he couldn't pull the trigger.
Right.
He was so obsessed with not getting taken down that he didn't use any offense, which is what his coach said. But I guess that's my point is like, maybe McGregor at this point is going to do six fights for the UFC, but they're going to be exhibition-style fights. I mean, they're still going to be fights, but maybe just playing around kind of things. Like, maybe he'll fight GSP.
He's kind of come into that area where it's McGregor versus, boom, a one-off, just like a superstar right. MMA fight.
Everything catchweight. They'll just make it work somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
Although, then I heard GSP yesterday saying he wanted to fight Khabib. Khabib was saying, I'll fight you.
Khabib also, and then Khabib came out and said he wants Floyd Mayweather. Dude, he would get knocked out in an instant.
In a boxing match?
In a boxing match. He wants Mayweather.
McGregor's a better striker than
Connor
Khabib.
Can at least box. Yeah, Connor's a boxer. You're
and
a wrestler,
he got war, and Mayweather carried him in that fight.
Right.
I mean, let him play for a little bit and hit him a couple times and said, all right, we're done.
Khabib would get knocked out, being able to take a guy down.
So do you do like the, I don't remember, I have to go look up, there was years ago, Muhammad Ali did a thing with a sumo wrestler where they did one. Like an exhibition.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the guy was trying to get Ali's legs, and he kept jumping up on the rings, on the ring rope. You gotta go find it.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
They should just do a triple gauntlet match.
It wasn't a sumo wrestler. It was a Japanese wrestler, though. But it was a wrestler. It was like a jujitsu kind of thing.
Okay.
And the guy kicked the crap out of Ali's legs. Ali had, like, messed up legs after the fight. But Ali, every time the guy got close to him, he would just punch down and just beat the crap out of him.
Right. And that's the only thing you could do is if it was at least a kickboxing match, because then Khabib could kick. But.
Right. So we people talk about like, well, what's to do with the UFC? Because Conor McGregor is one of the biggest sports stars in the world right now. In the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Name another world. Who's the biggest athlete in the world right now?
Biggest athlete? I mean, hard not to say LeBron just because it's LeBron.
Worldwide. Ronaldo?
Ronaldo. Somebody over there.
You can't really, you know, some of the football players, soccer players, you can't really say a football player for the U.S. Baseball, no.
No.
LeBron.
I think LeBron right? World, yeah.
Tiger? Tiger is a one-word guy.
I mean, he's
still
back
a
there
one-word
now,
guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He always will be.
But then Conor McGregor.
And I think Conor's kind of coming out of, I think you'll see more and more him coming out of the fighter fame into just the how Rousey did.
Yeah.
Where Rousey's just a household name for movies and everything, you know?
I'm surprised McGregor hasn't done a movie yet. It would work.
He would be perfect for one of those, like, WWE Marine 27 movies.
I'd love to see him in one of the Fast and Furious movies.
Oh, yeah, he would do that.
Send him over to Ireland.
Plus with his accent.
Oh, that's what I'm saying.
It would be great.
Big beard. He's like, he's a natural for those kind of films.
You wouldn't even have to write for him. He could just trash talk.
I don't envision romantic comedies with Conor McGregor.
No.
I brought you roses. Going to do the arm thing and walk up to the door. Then I just smack the mic stand there. All right. So your podcast, you got a new episode coming up this week as well?
Yes. It'll be out tomorrow.
And we'll always check out Ryan Inside the Ring as well. On iTunes, you can check it out. But ladies and gentlemen, Vern Lundquist, Jim O'Brien here in Detroit. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Jim. How are you?
Fantastic. And I'm one of the book is amazing. It was a quick read for me. I tore through it. And one of the things I wanted to start off with, you address what happened with Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan. Obviously, here in the Motor City, it happened here. But you address something in the book that I never really thought of, that if this hadn't gone down, Nancy would have been the sympathetic character at the Olympics.
Oh, gosh, yes. I can vividly remember January 6th of 94. I landed about 6 o'clock from Denver and landed in a snowstorm, and I'd been out of pocket all day. I got in the rental car and was heading for the Westin and had the radio station on, and they were talking about the attack on Nancy Kerrigan. That's how I first heard about it. And this is absolutely true. There was a function that night at the Westin Hotel, sponsored by the United States Figure Skating Association. And somewhere during that day, evening, I was in a conversation, and a senior vice president of that organization said to me, when we get to the bottom of this, and we will, I promise you, Tonya Harding will be involved. And she was, you know, she ultimately acknowledged that she was complicit in Jeff Galooly, her ex-husband, hiring a thug named Shane Stamp. And the hope was that they would disable Nancy to the extent that she couldn't compete, thus, in their kind of twisted logic, enhancing Tonya's chances. And it's one of the more extraordinary 6 weeks in my life, because there was something about, and all honest to God, I think we were complicit in this, we being CBS.
Yeah, you had Connie Chung over there, right? Didn't you have Connie Chung chasing her around during the Olympics?
Yes, indeed, that day, yeah, and that is explored. I'll tell you what, guys, Connie went out to Portland and co-anchored the evening news with Dan Rather from Portland, Oregon, from an ice rink where Tonya was practicing.
Seriously.
She followed her back to, I think they may have come through Detroit. I don't remember. But Connie was sitting across the aisle from her. And then anchored the evening newscast from Lillehammer. Actually, we were in a little town called Hamar, H-A-M-A-R. And the day of the first practice with both ladies on the ice, Kerrigan had been there for a week. Harding showed up barely in time to skate. I looked around the ice rink. They called it the Northern Lights Hall. And Tiny Chung was right below Scott Hamilton, Tracy Wilson, and me. And there were five other CBS broadcast crews inside the arena because we were the only ones with rights. Now, there were print journalists galore, but five different crews, correspondents, videographers, sound man, doing whatever angles they could find on this thing. And I can remember seeing them, and Scott looked down, and he was disgusted. And he said, somehow, somewhere, people have forgotten that we've got young men and women here who have worked all their lives to earn a medal in the Olympics, and we should be concentrating on that. But, and then just to end this part of a long story, that was on a Wednesday night. On Thursday night, our president at the time, Neil Pilsen, saw Scott and me at a practice. Have you heard about the ratings? And according to Nielsen, we had a 48.5 rating.
Wow.
Share. That means 48.5.
Wow.
And this number that he gave us has subsequently been lowered. But at the time, the estimated viewership was 126 million people.
Oh, I believe it, Vern. Vern Lundquist with us. Yeah, play-by-play the book. I have to ask, because there's so many stories in here. There's two things that jumped out at me I want to compliment you on. Your candid nature in the book, including when you talk about David Faraday and you touch on golf and the characters in there, you don't hold back, which I love, and you give me a little insight. But the Willie Anderson story, I have never heard this, and I cannot believe that you and Terry had the guts to pull that off.
Well, as you all have learned in the subsequent 24 years, Terry is an audacious human being. And the story quickly, and then let's tease it, guys, because HarperCollins wants to sell the book.
Exactly. I don't want to give away everything, but this just, yeah, it's a quick one.
There you are. Our first production meeting after we were put together was in 84. And I'll try and keep this brief as I can. In the production meeting, Terry said, let's have us fun. Let's invent us a football player. His idea was that in special team situations, everybody knows who the kicker is, who the return man, the punter, the punt returner, but nobody really knows what happens there in the scrum in the middle of the field. And that's how the career of this invented football player, Willie Anderson, I don't know how Terry came up with this, a free agent defensive back from Colby College in Maine. And I'll just give you one example, and this one is absolutely true. Morton Anderson ready to kick off. Billy Sims of Detroit is back to return it. And here's Sims out to the 20, 30, 35-yard line. And, boy, is he whacked as he gets to the 40-yard line. Lions will have the ball. Terry jumps in. I'll tell you what, Bubba, that was some tackle by Willie Anderson, the free agent defensive back from Colby College in Maine.
God, I love the story, and there's so much to it. You're right, Vern, I don't want to give it away, and I know our time is short with you. I do want to ask you while I got you on the phone, Play-by-Play is the name of the book. You got to read it. You got to read it if you're a fan of sports and just great broadcasting. There's a big game here in the Motor City this week in the state of Michigan, between Michigan and Michigan State. A lot of people said Harbaugh finally got his quality win, his, you know, beating Wisconsin. Is this turning the corner for Michigan from your perspective, or does he need to win out to really justify what he's doing in Ann Arbor?
Well, I'm not an expert on any conference, but I certainly know more about the SEC than I do the Big Ten. But I'm I've only done one football game in the Big House. I've done probably 20 basketball games, and the same is true of Michigan State. And I don't want to take the chicken way out, but I think it was a signature win, but I do think the pressure has subsided. Pressure, you know, every coach and every player has pressure every Saturday and every Sunday, and broadcasters do too, but to a much lesser degree. I think it's important that Michigan establish itself again, as we all perceive them to be. So let's call it a big win, but let's, as President Trump would say, let's see what happens.
There you go. Vern Lundquist, it's an honor talking to you. Next time I'm in Dallas, I'll take you out for cheese fries and snuffers, okay?
You got a deal. Thanks, guys.
All the best. Thank you, Vern. There it goes, Vern Lundquist. How cool was that? All right, so we move on from Vern. Again, the book, Play-by-Play, there really are some amazing stories in there. We go from talking sports, including football and everything else with Vern, to Jeff Perlman, Football for a Buck, all about the USFL. It's kind of funny that Vern mentioned Donald Trump, because Donald Trump obviously plays a huge part of the story of the USFL and when they attempted to move to the fall. So let's get him on the phone here. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming on with us here. Football for a Buck, the crazy rise and crazier demise of the USFL. Jeff Perlman. I always say that slow, Jeff, because I want people to get the book. Man, you've been getting just a huge response to this. Are you surprised by this?
I am, because I thought you and I were the only two people who cared about the USFL. Apparently, there are two or three others. Who knew?
Well, Chet Simmons knew when he came in, right? I mean, Chet Simmons is the commissioner of the league. He knew there was something there, because you even say in the book, he wasn't really a football guy. He was more of a baseball guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, on the one hand, he saw it as a job. He was hired as a commissioner of the USFL away from ESPN, and it was an intriguing job. And I think on the other hand, he was one of these guys who thought, you know, why can't spring football work? Like, why can't this work? What is it? What is the reason? Give me a reason spring football is a bad idea. And, you know, the only reason football is played in the fall, as the founder of the league always used to say, is because Princeton and Rutgers decided the first game of football would be played in October. And it was played in October, and then everyone made football a fall game. And these guys with the USFL were like, it's an incredibly popular sport. It's growing. Why not have it in the spring? Which I agree with.
But one of the key points in this book, obviously, is Donald Trump taking over the New Jersey Generals. The whole thing were really, you know, shocking. It was all about him, and he wanted to move this, you know, get his own team in the fall. Is there a point, when I first thought about when the owners went along with him, and these are all very successful businessmen in varying degrees, did they do it just because of the force of it, or did they just go, screw it, I don't have a choice, he's going to do this anyway, so I might as well go along with it?
I think it was a combination. I think on the one hand, they all knew going in, like part of the plan or part of the idea was, look, you're going to lose money at first. And it was like, okay, we'll lose money at first. I know we're going to lose money at first. It's a long-term investment. But then you actually lose the money, and it's not that fun. And this guy comes along and he says, look, there's all this money to be made in the fall. We should just, why are we playing in the spring? We should move to the fall. There's so much money. And I think a lot of them said the force of Trump's sort of, you know, force of will, and also this idea that, well, maybe there is money to be made in the fall, and maybe this isn't a great idea. And they didn't know. They definitely didn't know that he was full of crap and that his whole goal was to land in the NFL. They just thought, well, maybe he knows something we don't know. And they kind of, I mean, you see with him, the guy, whether you like him or not, he has a sort of weird, I guess, charisma or cult-like sort of ability to get people to follow him, even if they're walking off a cliff.
You don't think the owners were looking at this as their out? We're like, okay, well, we know Trump's going to, he's going to just mess this up by trying to go to the fall. This is our out to get out of this losing proposition that's the USFL.
I don't, because I think there were saner and more profitable ways to get out than to, I mean, by going to fall, half the teams are just completely killing the value of the franchise. I mean,
yeah.
Once you move to fall and you're the Michigan Panthers, well, you're not going to play in the same stadium as the Detroit Lions in the same days and the same time of year. If you're the Houston Gamblers or the Houston Oilers are there, the Pittsburgh Maulers, the Steelers are there, the Chicago Blitz, the Bears are there. It's just, it made no sense whatsoever for a lot of those teams, but they just were railroaded. They really were.
So who was the guy from the Michigan Panthers that got wound up naked on the ice at the Joe?
Yeah. John Corker was a linebacker, really, really good player who had a lot of substance abuse issues, and he did a lot of things. He was crazy, and one thing he did is one night one morning he wakes up and he's asleep with his face on the ice at Joe Louis Arena, and kind of like that scene from Christmas Story. His face is attached to the ice, and he has to rip his face off. I mean, another time, Bobby Hebert, the quarterback of the Panthers, told me he and John Corker were invited to speak at some function, and there's a middle of winter, and snowing hard, and Corker's said, I'll drive, and they're speeding in this little sports car to this event, and John Corker's smoking joints as he's driving like 90 miles per hour through the ice and snow. And Hebert is from Louisiana. This is a young, naive kid from Louisiana. He's convinced they're going to die as Corker is just driving high out of his mind through the snow. And amazingly, they get there. That was kind of John Corker.
Well, and then, you know, you think about, I know one of the things you talk about in the book was the whole idea that they had a salary cap in place. It was they had all agreed upon. They were only going to spend so much. They were going to, you know, limit their expenses and let the league build naturally in the word of mouth. But in a lot of ways, the Michigan Panthers kind of were the first ones to kind of break that mold with the linemen, weren't we?
Yeah, they kind of ruined it. Because basically what happened is that 83, the first season, the Panthers at one point early on were a 500 team, and the owner, Al Taubman, he just was really frustrated because Hebert was being kind of harassed. And they had these really good offensive weapons. They had, you know, Bobby Hebert and Ken Lacy and Anthony Carter and Derek Holloway. So he goes out and he signs three former Pittsburgh Steelers offensive linemen for a lot of money. And when he did that, and they went on to win the championship that year.
Yeah.
So football-wise, it was smart. But for the league, it sort of said to the other owners, I mean, if this guy is going to spend millions on offensive linemen, why am I holding back from getting that tight end we need? Why am I holding back from getting another halfback? Vince Evans is a free agent. Why aren't I signing Vince Evans? So it kind of opened the floodgates where a lot of other teams looked at the Panthers and said, if they're going to do it, we're going to do it too.
Isn't it funny? I mean, just it's kind of an aside here, Jeff, but to me, like, when we look at NASCAR, just as a racing thing, there's the same thing's going on right now. It's not the drivers. It's the owners that are jacking the cost up by all this technology and all these four-post things and these millions and millions of dollars of R&D that they're driving themselves out of their own cars, pardon the car pun, because it costs so damn much to build and build a competitive race car. And the USFL did the same thing to themselves with the owners initially.
I actually feel like one thing I learned from this whole experience, I'm really sad, I really mean this, I'm not just saying it, is I think we tend to assume that people who have made a lot of money or people who have a lot of money know what they're doing. You know, we sort of give them the benefit.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
That's a successful business person. And then, I mean, the USFL, it's just, they were so ridiculously dumb about it all. And they just got really competitive and really greedy and really short-sighted. And you realize, like, these people are just like us, just on a bigger scale. You know, they're no different than us when I have a bill to pay, but man, that donut looks really good. You know, oh, I'm gonna get the donut and I'll be okay. Like, we all have these impulses and these lapses of judgment, and they just had on a really big scale.
Am I the only person? I can't be the only person. I'm probably the last person to notice that the I always wondered that the Panthers helmet, was it intentionally designed to sort of copy a little bit of U of M's football?
No, it was not. I thought you were going to say, if you look at the Carolina Panthers helmet, it's very similar.
Oh, it is.
To the Michigan Panthers helmet. And people always say that they copy off that. That I don't know. I do think the coolest thing about the Michigan Panthers, their colors, one of their colors was champagne, which I just think is ridiculously cool. They have the best uniforms ever, and champagne is just kind of badass.
But you know, like the way the Panther kind of curves, if you look at it from a distance, exactly, it's got that U of M look to it.
Yeah. I've never heard that. So I can't, I mean, it's possible. I've never heard that. The one thing obviously is the naming the team, the Panthers was sort of sticking in the eye of the Lions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Best uniform in the USFL. I don't know. What was the best one for you? For me, it was the Gamblers. I love the Houston Gamblers uniform. That was strong.
All right. So I love the Houston Gamblers, and I also love the, so the Oklahoma Outlaws and the Arizona Wranglers merged.
Right.
And so it was black and sort of this, like, gold. And it was Doug Williams was a quarterback. I always say nobody's ever looked cooler than Doug Williams in 1985 wearing a they were a terrible team, but wearing the Arizona Outlaws uniform were really cool.
The Breaker one, I always thought that somebody lost a bet and had to put that on there. It never made any – it looked like they were like something you would see on Pacific Princess Cruise.
Yeah, see, it's funny. A lot of people love that helmet.
Really?
A lot of people love that helmet. Yeah, a lot of people name that as their favorite helmet. I always thought the Stars were the best team in the league, but I always thought their helmets were really boring.
Yeah.
I never liked the Denver Gold helmet, which is just kind of an exploding sun. Yeah, but there were a lot of – I mean, the San Antonio Gunslingers is utterly ridiculous. It looks like – someone said to me it looks like Woody on crack, Woody from Toy Story.
It does.
But it's also really kind of – it's really memorable at the same time. It's so 80s weird, you know.
Hey, what happened to Kelvin Bryant when the USFL disbanded? I don't know.
Oh, well, he went to the Washington Redskins. I always say, like, if you want to know the impact of the USFL and the NFL and you want to fully understand it, when the Redskins won the Super Bowl in 87 and they beat the Denver Broncos, their quarterback was Doug Williams, and he threw four touchdown passes in that game. Three of them were – one was the Kelvin Bryant, Philadelphia Stars. One was a Ricky Sanders, Houston Gamblers. And one was to Gary Clark, Jacksonville Bulls. Mm-hmm. So, and Doug Williams played for the Oklahoma Outlaws. So talk about the USFL impact. And Kelvin Bryant was, I think, the best offensive player in the USFL, even better than Herschel Walker. But
I agree.
His knees were sort of shot by the time he got to the NFL. So it wasn't there anymore.
It is, and it's a great book, Jeff. There's so much in here that I think I said it on Twitter, and I'll say it to you. There are three sports books now that I have on my shelf. I think when you get older, I don't know what it is now, like with Kindles and everything else, you don't have as many books out as we used to have. But no. yours is on the shelf next to Summer 49 by Halberstam about the Yankees and the Red Sox, and Go Like Hell by A.J. Bame about Ford versus Ferrari.
Oh, man. Well, I'm really flattered by that. But it might just be because my book is the newest. And as soon as you go to the Goodwill store next week, you're going to be bringing it with you.
Yeah, I'm waiting for someone to do one about the California Sun. If they can do a documentary on them and the 1 year they played at Anaheim Stadium, that'll be the next book.
Oh, that would be good. Yeah, that's not mine.
Eight people got that reference right now. The LA Express, as bad as Trump was with the generals and all that stuff and what he was doing behind the scene, nobody. That owner for the Express, and that was stuff I didn't know. I was a junior in high school and watching the LA Express, and I'm like, man, Steve Young is awesome. We knew who he was. And then you're watching him play, and you're at the Coliseum, and you don't really notice the crowd as much when you're trying to watch it on TV if it's on or reading about him. But that owner was flat-out Looney Tunes, man.
Yeah, Bill Odenberg. He was crazy. He had he showed up at one of the owner meetings early on, and he actually got drunk, pulled down his pants, and said, "If you want to dance with the big boys, you got to know how to boogie woogie with the king." I think that really set the tone. He was crazy. He was an SNL kind of con man. He didn't have the money he said he had. To show you what kind of guy he was, they're negotiating. They had an offensive lineman in who they were going to sign, and they're at dinner, and the offensive lineman, the agent, and the owner, Odenberg, and the GM, Don Klosterman, and he says, he's starting to get drunk, and they're negotiating, and he just says, to hell with it. Just give him whatever he wants. Give him whatever money he wants. I don't care. Just give it to him. And he's in front of the agent. The agent's like, oh, this is the best day ever. Guy ends up signing like some multi-million-dollar deal, and his nickname becomes Limo, because on the first day of practice, he actually took a limo onto the field. The guy didn't care. He just was throwing money around left and right, and he guaranteed the other owners, the LA Express, would open up 84 to a sellout crowd of 90,000 people, because his friend was Wayne Newton, and Wayne Newton was going to perform a concert. And there was, I think they probably drew about 20,000 to 90,000.
That's being liberal.
Yeah, they can never draw.
No, you just the thing about just aside. I mean, growing up in California, I was a San Diego sports fan. I'm still a Charger fan. I've been since I was 5 years old. But we didn't care. It was not that we didn't care about the team. It's just if it's 78 and sunny and I can go to the beach or I can go sit at a stadium for 3 hours. If the team's not great, I ain't going. I'm going somewhere else. There's like 1,000 other things to do in SoCal than go watch a crappy Angels team or go watch the LA Express with three people you know. It just that's the way it was.
Right, which is, I can't say it's too bad, but some of those Steve Young performances back then, they were really magical. And it was like, it's actually interesting because Steve Young is an LA Express quarterback straight out of BYU. He was wildly entertaining because he didn't really know what he was doing yet. And it made him all the more entertaining because he had all these physical gifts and all these skills. But he was, he was just sort of running wild and it wasn't disciplined. And he didn't have Jerry Rice and he didn't have, Roger Craig. He was just dropping back and sort of scanning the field and half the time taking off. And some of the highlights from the LA Express are really kind of crazy, but in a very enjoyable way.
Well, that's like you talk, like you said, like with Steve Young, you can go back and watch that 49ers-Vikings run. I'm like, yeah, we saw that in the USFL a couple of years ago.
Right.
He did that already.
Exactly. They were a bunch of NFL players. They had two Hall of Famers. Gary Zimmerman was on that team as well. I mean, they were great.
So if Trump never happened in the USFL, or Trump came in and said, I will just eliminate the whole fall thing. If the USFL, the way it was going, had stayed in the spring, would it have survived?
No, probably not. But I think you would have had a merger. I think you would have had an absorption. You look back, 1987 was the NFL player strike, and you had real anarchy in football. And you also had all these players looking for work. And I just think if the USFL had hung out until 87, the NFL would have panicked. And USFL had a team in Jacksonville before the Jaguars. They had a team in Tennessee before the Titans. They had a team in Baltimore. They had a team in Oakland. Birmingham did very well. And the funny thing is, even Trump's master diabolical plan was to get a team in New York City, an NFL team in New York City, because the Jets moved to New Jersey. I'm not convinced that couldn't have happened if the USFL hung around and hung around and hung around and sort of pressured the NFL. But they got really greedy on the quick, and they ended up killing themselves.
It's an amazing story. The book is fantastic. Jeff Perlman with us, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Is this the sort of book you could turn into a movie?
You want to put the money into it, I'm in. Let's do it.
Seriously, though, I mean, you think about, like, we look at stories and stuff, and you've got so many freaking crazy stories in here. This is ball four-ish. I mean, you could do this. You could tell this story of the USFL. I'm not sure it wouldn't so much be the generals. Maybe it would be, but you could tell these stories and absolutely turn this into some sort of a book. Which team would you want to do a movie on?
Oh, I would do the Gunslingers. I just think the Gunslingers. I mean, I could tell. I mean, the Gunslingers are the most amazing team I've ever written about. They could have been a book on themselves, but nobody would have bought it. But it was, among other things, just randomly. They were coached by a guy who had early onset dementia, coached from the stand sitting next to his wife with a walkie-talkie, had seven fingers because he lost three in a lawnmower accident. They had a player who they put on the disabled list because he slammed his penis in a trunk.
They played on a field that was it was super paper thin AstroTurf for top cement, and they used, the team was so cheap, they bought industrial spray paint to spray the field instead of using this sort of proper protective paint. So when players skidded on the field, not only would they open these huge cuts on their bodies from these burn cuts from the turf, but they would get this cheap paint embedded in the cuts. Early on in the first season, Rick Neuheisel was a quarterback from UCLA, and one of the officials of the team pulled him aside and asked what color uniforms should they supply the visiting teams when they come to town. They stopped paying players at the end of the second year. They just stopped paying. And they had a defensive lineman named Greg Fields who started with the Express. And while he was with the Express, he got cut and he punched his coach, John Hadle, in the face.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the Express had to hire Liberace's bodyguard to protect the coach. Well, the gunslinger signed Greg Fields, and he goes to San Antonio, and the owner stops paying players. So he follows the owner home one day with a baseball bat and threatens him. And the owner pays him $17,000 in cash just to go away. I mean, it's the best team of all time. The Gunslinger. I can tell you no more. The Gunslinger is the best story ever. I would watch that movie in a second.
Remember, Slapshot was nothing more than a pitch from a lady in L.A. that her brother played in that hockey league. And he flew out and pitched it. I mean, you've just pitched a movie right there, Jeff.
Hey, I think it's great. Okay. I do.
I've got $12, so I'm in. All right.
Nice. All right, I'll throw in my 12. We got 24.
Congratulations, dude. This is awesome, man. I mean, it really is. It's a wonderful read. It's a fun sports book. And I'm telling you, here's the last thing. I'll leave you with this. I was thinking about this. With a lot of the stuff going on between the owners and the players, obviously over the past 24 months, if a USFL popped up today, if somebody decided to go back and do spring football, would you have the same migration of players? I think they could possibly be successful.
I don't know. I think it'd be really hard. The NFL is much, 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 much more powerful than it was then. It's bigger. It has its own network. It's playing, three different days during the week. The brand, the shield, just so much more powerful. I think it'd be really hard to tell players, yeah, you know what, leave the NFL and join this upstart league that has a crappy grade B TV deal. And I don't know. I just think it's different times. People are less daring now. People are more corporate now. Could it happen? Maybe. It'd be really hard, though.
Well, you look at college football, and in a lot of ways, college football is almost a form of pro football without paying the players.
Well, and sometimes paying the players.
Could Alabama beat the Buffalo Bills this year? Probably. They'd give them a hell of a game.
No, I don't think.
I know. I'm joking, but I mean, they'd give them a good game.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's such a different level. I just think it's tough. The NFL has such a head start. And people keep saying, oh, the NFL's in trouble or the NFL's struggling. But if you look at the ratings and you look at the numbers, I mean, I would love to struggle like the NFL's struggling.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, Jeff, man, thanks for the time, bud. The book's great. And so what's next? What are you working on now?
I'm doing my next book is about the Lakers of the 90s, 2000s. So the Shaq, Kobe era Lakers.
Oh, you mean the ones that we beat here in Detroit? Those ones?
Yes, that would be that exact team.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the championship team that nobody talks about. Yeah, man.
I'll make that my book after that.
All right, good deal. And then you and I will work on the San Antonio Gunslingers movie. That's some great stuff, man.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks, Jeff.